Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 131. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Evoox, YouTube, on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, in the podcast section, and it'll be on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog and the podcast section. I want to remind you that I wrote two books, Freedom Through Memedom and The Kids Are Not All Right. You can check them out on Amazon. They are also available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store, where you can buy them for cryptocurrency. Today, I am welcoming Cody Wilson to the show. Cody is the director of Defense Distributed. In 2013, Cody invented the world's first 3D printable gun, the Liberator. And as soon as he did, he uploaded the plans to it to the internet. Well, all hell broke loose. The government got involved. And in just the past couple weeks, the court case was finally settled. I don't know if that's the right word. I'll let Cody explain it to you. So without any further delay, here is Cody Wilson. So I'm here with Cody Wilson. How you doing, Cody?
Good, brother. Thanks for having me.
Man, you've been busy as shit, huh?
Hey, man, sometimes all that hard work pays off, doesn't it?
That's crazy, man. Let's start out. Before we talk about the recent court successes, I sort of want to build up to that. Let's go back 6 years and tell me about the founding of Defense Distributed. What was the goal with starting the company?
The goal even then, like, I didn't have the language or the philosophy of crypto anarchy yet. I hadn't discovered it. I discovered it like during this project. But the goal then was, you know, from a place of millennial dissatisfaction with me and my friends in Little Rock, Arkansas, we were like, gosh, you know, the only thing even happening is WikiLeaks. This was like 2011, you know, late 2011. You know, what's another way of doing something like WikiLeaks? Is there a way to apply WikiLeaks to things we like? And my co-founder, Ben Denio, was like, well, you know, maybe there's WikiLeaks for guns, you know, maybe we could distribute guns somehow. And so we were like, well, what are the technologies of the present that would somehow enable us to put guns on the internet? What does that look like? And it's not that interesting if it's just files for guns. So, like, are there replicators? And we had heard of 3D printing. So the question was, well, can you 3D print a gun? And, like, if you can, you somehow, like, generate that into its own meta-political controversial project? So all the elements of this project and even, like, the rhetoric within the result that I use today was all pretty much formed there immediately. Like, the idea got in the driver's seat and took us for a ride. We were just, from the beginning, trying to implement the idea of WikiLeaks for guns.
Why guns? What in your background or what in your philosophy makes guns so important to you?
I think in this, really, it was just political realism. What is the essence of power? You know, I've been a pretty good libertarian up to that point. I'd understood the nature of power relative to the individual versus the state, and, you know, how do you reset that equation? How do you do things for the benefit of the individual contra the power of the state? And the gun is always central to that in my imagination. I've got a train coming, by the way.
I hear it. No worries, man. Tell me about the Liberator, and, you know, talk about some of the storm that happened around it.
Liberator was, like, fast forwarding in this project, Liberator took about 6 months to really do. So when we inaugurated our project, WikiWeapon, Defense Distributed, we said, look, we think at some point we'll be able to print like an entire gun. And this wasn't, no one really accepted that we could do it, but they credited us more and more as we tried. But we actually got there at one point in the spring of 2013. We assembled this full gun, and most of it was cannibalized from files we'd already had experience with. A lot of the grip face and the receiver body, and it all comes from AR-15 geometry. And then we had custom built a barrel after some months of barrel testing and different gun concepts. And then we stole the springs from, like, this toy on MakerBot. I think a lot of people didn't expect that we would print even the springs in something like the Liberator. When we named it, that was really when I began to introduce, like, hard theory into what we were doing. Its name comes from this failed psychological operation from World War II, this idea that we would maybe drop stamped metal pistols all over occupied Europe, and somehow this would enable latent resistant forces to really give hell to the occupying Nazi power. And anyway, it was this psychological operation. And they never really went for it. It never happened. But there it sat kind of as like a historical trivia. And when I was reading a lot of Badiou at the time, and he said that events often have an element of repetition to them. Like you have to kind of attempt, and anything new is always kind of like the successful implementation of something that had failed in the past, and the rescuing of some unused or almost failed political event. So I thought, well, okay, we'll name it Liberator, and we'll like actually drop the guns all over the world, right? We'll put it into the internet, and we'll use the logic of the West kind of against itself. And so this is Baudrillard a little bit too, that it was only like the designs of the West that even gave us this idea, and how interesting that through the internet this should return against them, but now to mess with them instead of, you know, the occupying power in World War II. Maybe that's like answering too much of your question, but
that was pretty cool, actually. So, and you were 25 when all this started, right?
I was 24. I was 24 for the whole first year of DD and the Liberator.
That's amazing, man. That's, if I told you what I was doing at 24.
Man, I was otherwise there was nothing noteworthy about me, man. I was a law school dropout, basically. I wasn't going to school. I was just learning how to use a 3D printer. And when exam week came around, instead of taking my tests, I got in trouble with the feds, you know.
Talk about that. As soon as you dropped that on the internet, it seems like, was it like right away, or how long did it take before the feds took notice?
Yeah, the feds were right on top of it immediately. And now I think why is more difficult to answer, and we'll never really know. Like, part of my hope in starting the federal lawsuit like a year later was, well, maybe it would proceed to discovery and I'd figure out what happened to sick them on me, but I'll never know now. We've outlasted like two governments at this point. But I had built this file sharing site to share the file on, and that site had already been pretty successful for a few months. You know, we'd had millions of downloads of other types of files and things. So when I finally put the Liberator on it, that was like the cherry on top, and the feds were right there on it. It was about 2 days later that I got the email with the letter in it. And that was, you know, I did other things, of course, but that was the next 5 years of my life contending with that letter.
They were monitoring the site. I mean, that's just the, yeah, I mean.
I'm a mischievous libertarian, so I'd had server monitoring on and stuff, and with some frequency I would publish, you know, here are the governments around the world today on defcat.com, you know, and it would always be, sometimes you'd get unusual results. It was like NASA, like, what's NASA doing hanging out for, you know, 3 hours a day on, or like it was, you know, newyork.gov, so it was state governments and stuff too, but always DHS, always DOJ. Yeah, they're watching. They watch.
So, when you, let's go back a little bit. When you first wanted to start to do 3D printing, you had to get access to a 3D printer, and that proved to be difficult. What happened?
Yeah. My first thought was, well, if I'd raised enough money, I would just lease one myself. Not even buy one, but just lease one. And the political purpose of the project was, you know, it'd be one thing to just get like an expensive 3D printer and print a gun on it and be like, look at what I have done. But to make the threat credible of worldwide immediate access to downloadable guns through 3D printing, we knew we needed to print a gun that other people could print with the most kind of commonly available materials and printers that were there at the time. So I got a printer that I knew could approximate, but in a more reliable format, the materials and print quality that were in the retail printers at the time. I leased that printer. I brought it to my apartment in Austin, Texas, my student apartment at the time. And within like 24 hours, I think, or, you know, 48 hours, the company that leased it to me, I don't know, found out what I actually intended to do with it. And they sent me an email saying like, yeah, we'll be picking this up tomorrow. And I actually didn't even have a time to unbox it, really. It was still kind of unboxed, and they sent a crack team out and put it on a truck. And then at that point, I was like, okay, I'll never have a 3D printer again. I'll just have to find someone else's and work with that.
Yeah, I watched The New Radical the day it came out, and good. So what were you gonna say?
No, I was saying thanks.
Oh yeah, I mean it was it blew me away. You know, just sitting there on a Friday night and having a little drink and just being like, damn, the shit that he went through to do this, man. But you ended up having to. How did you finally end up getting a printer to do this?
There's lots of answers to that. I mean, as the months went on, I got a bit more sophisticated in everything. So I would go to the different prototyping bureaus and service bureaus around Austin. Lucky that I lived in Austin, right? This is all, everything would be different if I wasn't in a city like this. I would go to those places that had 3D printers, and about half of them were willing to work with me if I paid them, you know. I paid them for machine time. And then some of them offered engineering support as well. So in those months after that confiscation, I began to actually really teach myself commercial 3D printing and the industry and the best practices. And I would begin with components of AR-15s and receivers, and I would test them with different materials, it was just trial and error with these different bureaus. So at one point it got to where two or three places around town were printing two or three different types of files for me, all variations on, you know, the same concept. And I began to kind of intuit better what worked and what didn't for our applications. And then as that went on and I would publish progress in our printing, people began to volunteer machine time to me. Old professionals in Liberty Hill and other places who even had industry connections began to kind of take me under their wing, and engineers began to volunteer their time as well. So very, very quickly, by the end of 2012, I had a lot of talent that I could draw on to actually, you know, design a path to get to my goal.
Now, when does the lawsuit start?
Let's see. Okay, well, I got my letter, let's say like 2 or 3 days after I posted Liberator. That was May of 2013. And, immediately you want to fight something when you get a subpoena or when a libertarian gets stopped by the police or something, right? You immediately want to but it's not exactly easy to get into federal court. You know, you can't just go the next day. At that point, I didn't know many appellate attorneys or practicing federal attorneys anyway. But I had made enough connections to where, you know, I was close with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I was close with the Second Amendment Foundation, at least on speaking terms with people there. And I was able to use that network to say, look, I'm in a defensive posture at the moment. My immediate concerns were compliance and not going to jail, because it doesn't do me a lot of good, and I won't be able to plan well from jail. So the first attorneys I got with Export were like, look, I was like, keep me out of jail for the next 90 days. And look, we didn't know what was going to happen. We thought this was just going to proceed immediately into like an enforcement or criminal scenario. So the ground game in the short term was keep me out of jail for as long as possible. Hopefully you can give me 90 days before we're in front of a judge or something. And then I try to put together a team and a plan to build a federal case, which at first I imagined to be a defense, like a federal defense. But as time wore on, as that summer wore on in 2013, I recognized that the government didn't intend to do anything else. They were going to swallow me up in this, what's this called, a commodity jurisdiction process. And it's an interagency thing. It involves multiple bureaus of the executive branch, like the Commerce Department, the Homeland Security, and the Army, the DOD. And it was clear to me that they didn't intend to actually answer the questions. They just wanted to kind of suffocate what I was doing or just make sure that it was over. And so then it took another year for me to put the full team together. This involved appellate attorney Alan Gura, who got us the Heller decision that created the modern Second Amendment. Alan Gottlieb, their support, the Second Amendment Foundation agreed to come on and pay about a quarter of my fees if I could put the team together. And then I got wise counsel from people like Gene Hoffman of CalGuns and others. I mean, I didn't know how much a federal suit of this kind would cost. So it turns out those estimates were like wildly off, like they were really, really underestimated, but it was enough to give me the confidence to try to slowly put the team together and then reconfigure my company. Like, my company had only made money in file sharing before, but I knew if I was going to have a multi-year federal thing that I would need to have a better plan or do something else to make money. You can't just rely on people giving you money, you know. So I pivoted Defense Distributed in that time in 2014 into a hardware company that would begin selling a mill. And when I started selling the mill, I told customers directly, this is to help fund a lawsuit for me. and you can fast forward pretty much from there. I did a lot of, in my mind, interesting and cool things in the meantime, but it was all so that I could fund and ultimately win this lawsuit.
Whose decision was it to make this a free speech issue, a First Amendment issue?
That was always where it was. It's, of course, something that affects the Second Amendment in American gun politics, but the real nature, like the facts of the case and the regulation at issue, is a regulation that asks you, before you publish something, to submit it to the government and get its approval before you can publish. So that's a regime of speech control, of prior restraint, in the most classic sense. And even better, it had no procedural safeguards. Like, it had no due process protections. So it was so vulnerable. And there was also a history of suing the government over the use of the ITAR. 20 years ago, you know, a generation ago, the same laws had been used to try to prevent the public from getting access to encryption technologies, public key encryption. And it took Bernstein had to sue the State Department, just like I did, and it took him bringing them to the Ninth Circuit like two times before the Clinton administration finally backed off. And now you have, in my case, 20 years later, the same thing. We were like, no, Americans have the unquestioned right to access this data and share it online. You're using the ITAR for impermissible reasons, you know, as gun control by other means. So we took it to the Fifth Circuit, the Supreme Court, and finally, when it got to the merits, the State Department had to run away from it.
So that's basically the ruling that was, is it earlier this month or later in June?
Well, technically, it's a settlement. So a judge's ruling had no part in it. The judge can only accept now the settlement that the DOJ and I made together. But the settlement was basically saying the State Department agrees to walk away. And because now I have to admit, I have to basically... The State Department never had to admit that it didn't have this power, which was critical to them. They never had to admit that they did anything wrong, but they paid me for my attorney's fees and stuff and my registrations. But as long as they were able to maintain, you know, safe face and walk away from it without being, you know, humiliated, they were willing to basically under the table say, we no longer control this. We no longer intend to control it. And I was even given special authority to publish things before some of these other rules changed.
Yeah, and it seems like you, as soon as this happened, you dropped a whole bunch of stuff online, right? I mean, like, what are some of the blueprints for 3D printing that you've dropped since this happened?
Not a lot of new stuff for 3D printing, but I showcased DefCat almost immediately afterward. That's the new, well, the oldest. That's the site that's gone back online. Anyone can join. Anyone can download. And right now it's only defense distributed files, but it shows files that we've been able to digitize over all that time, including like entire assemblies of the AR-10 and the AR-15, you know, America's rifles. And these aren't, let's say, 3D printable per se. These aren't one-to-one 3D printable. But what's important is this settlement extends to not just the IP related to 3D printing, which is admittedly still a niche and kind of bizarre thing in its infancy, but it applies to all the technical data related to the entirety of our culture and the entirety of gun culture. So all that data, NC code, CAD files, engineered drawings, blueprints, all of it, you know, has now been ensured safe passage into the 21st century, onto the internet, in a place where it should be readily available for anyone who needs it in all times to come.
You said before that you were, do you sell mills?
Yeah, I have a website, ghostgunner.net, and just over the last few years, it kind of became one of the biggest 80% suppliers and techniques. So I sell a mill that helps you finish 80% and AR-15s and 1911s, and probably at the end of this month, the beginning of next, we'll show our Glock functionality. It's a little platform that, you know, you can engrave with. You can do lots of stuff with it. It's just a little mini mill.
Do you have any plans on design? Coming out with 3D printers of your own?
Maybe. It's funny that you ask. I mean, nothing that I'd really publicly advertise right now, but some people have been leaving major companies and I've been looking at hiring a guy, which I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, like, I don't know that there's lots of money to be made in it. And I'm so pulled now by new things. Like, I have to totally rebuild DefCat. It's a big site. In the past, it was like a world level site. You know, it required co-location and all kinds of help from data centers and stuff to keep it going. It was not a small feat for some 25-year-old kid, you know, to run that thing. So I know it's going to take a lot of effort to run it again. And I want to do everything, right? But I have to recognize that we'll have to save room for other people in our culture to proceed ahead and do interesting, innovative things. I've got to consolidate, at least with this at this time, with this victory, ensure this platform is stable, build out some of what we've already built, and hope that other people want to contribute.
It's funny when you just said you have to leave room open for other people. I automatically thought that in a not anonymous way that you could possibly be considered the Satoshi Nakamoto of 3D gun printing.
Look, you know, that's quite a compliment. But you know, unlike Satoshi, I guess I didn't need to hide what I was doing, and I'm thankful for that. So you can ask this Satoshi what he thinks, and he'll tell you. Okay.
Well, let me ask you this. There are still a plethora of laws on the books. The NFA still exists. States can make their own laws about guns. What are your feelings about what you've been able to accomplish on the future of gun control?
Well, I think time will tell, but this seems to have been quite a victory. In fact, it even has an unanticipated element for the State Department, who's actually in charge of assigning like what is and isn't, what does and doesn't have military use, what is and isn't a weapon of war. The State Department said all semi-automatics up to 50 caliber are no longer considered military, which is very interesting if you're going to file a brief challenging an assault weapons ban, let's say, where some of these circuits have adopted language from Bloomberg and these others saying, oh, you know, we have to keep these weapons of war off our streets. Well, unfortunately, the federal government doesn't see it your way. That could become useful, I think, in the future when, let's say, a Judge Kavanaugh is sitting and they've granted cert on an assault weapons ban case.
Yeah. I wanted to jump into cryptocurrency because I know that's another thing that you've been on for a while. You've been a Bitcoin evangelist for, you know, since what year did you start getting into crypto?
I began accepting Bitcoin in 2012. I even spoke at London's first Bitcoin conference in 2012. That was probably the best decision I ever made in my life.
Was it because of people that you met there, and or why was that?
It was because Bitcoin was $12, and I got a whole bunch of it.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, so I know you've been busy, but you're obviously following cryptocurrency. And in December, everything exploded. I mean, it was just absolutely nuts. And it's come back down. I mean, it's to the point where, you know, people like Peter Schiff, who I love on everything except cryptocurrency. It's like I could listen as soon as he starts talking about it on his podcast, I shut it off. I'm done. But
yeah, it's weird hostility. Yeah,
you know, it's very, very odd. But what do you see? What happened? What's your take on what happened between December and now?
The space got hot. It got overheated. You know, everybody was a bit of a mania. And there have been manias like this in the past. I remember the first run up to 1,000. You know, I was there for that. And it had a lot of the same feelings. These things will be cyclical. I think when we saw Bitcoin 10,000 last year, that wasn't the last time we'd see 10,000. I think we'll see 20,000 again. No problem. But, you know, there'll be some calamitous run up to 100,000 probably, and everyone's going to lose their ass when it crashes back down 70%. You know, it's just it's the way it goes. It's markets, it's animal spirits, it's just the nature of these network effects and people piling into something that is new that they don't understand, and all this other kind of I don't know, what is it called, like the last fool or whatever, like greatest fool. There's a ton of effects at work, you know.
Well, I think, you know, you talked about people losing their ass. If it doesn't hit 100,000 by the end of the year, I think McAfee's going to lose his dick.
Because he's been saying it or something? He's on Twitter every day saying it?
He said at the beginning, he said what in the run-up in December that if it didn't hit 100,000 by December 31st, 2008, he would eat his dick on TV.
That can mean a number of things. Let's hope that Mr. McAfee is more flexible now, and perhaps he'll post this on Pornhub or something. I won't watch it. You can tell me what you think about it.
I'm not going to watch it.
In the very earliest days, like even when Bitcoin was, you know, 250 and other things, I remember in 14 and 15 being told, oh, hyper Bitcoinization, you know, oh, it's going to just run away. At some point, it'll go straight logarithmic and Bitcoin 1 million, no problem. It's possible. I mean, I see all the monetary economics make sense to me. I don't see why it wouldn't happen if it truly is a stable currency and a hard money. Sorry, stable currency not even necessary, but if it truly is a money of an order of magnitude better than all the other hard monies ever made, I don't see why it wouldn't happen. So your best strategy is probably to hang tight. I certainly wouldn't sell right now. I would not. If you have Bitcoin, don't use it. Don't sell it. That doesn't make sense to me.
What is your... Well, it was funny. You were mentioning the run up and people who are going to buy all their, and they're going to lose their ass. And I was thinking about Austrian economics. And somebody recently asked the question, with Austrian economics, have you learned how to make money? And the person said, no, I learned how not to lose money.
Oh, wow. Well, that's interesting. I've never heard that said before through Austrian economics, but it mirrors some of the theories of like entrepreneurship, if you will, that the entrepreneur doesn't use causal based reasoning. He uses effectual reasoning, and often one of the biggest elements of effectual reasoning is not how can I go find this opportunity, how can I benefit and make money, but given current factors, how can I not lose money? This is probably the first way to think on the road to knowledge and wisdom. So good that Austrian economics would teach you that.
Well, and even Schiff, even someone like Schiff talks about that. He talks about, you know, when he talks about gold, yeah, he says the point of gold is not that you're going to get rich. The point of gold is that you're going to stay rich. And
I like that. And in an environment like this, when we fight monetarism on an international scale, right, the debasement of currencies and the total just, you know, I don't know, unfettered production of bank money and all these secret credit facilities and everything. I mean, they're constantly diluting the value of the people's money. Anything that can like let you hedge out of that or just exit is wise to use and to be in. I think in these terms too, but I'm enthusiastic for Bitcoin, not because of its ability to personally enrich me, but because it seems that it really would be a backstop against the excesses of the state.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about when we talk about cryptocurrencies, ever since December, and especially starting in December, and when it started coming down, a war is going on where the altcoins are making Bitcoin, you know, the more there are out there, the more it makes, you know, Bitcoin or Ethereum or Bitcoin Cash or Litecoin, it makes them look less valuable. And I'm one of these people who's like, free market, the best will win. And what's your take on seeing all these altcoins that have come out, and what's your take on that?
I mean, it's more of this greater fool stuff. Like, I'm not against it. I would never say that the state should step in to stop it. I think it's funny that the state did step in to stop some of it, but mostly it's just mania, right? A lot of altcoins, from my experience, especially since last year, the ICO mania seems to be based on, you know, fear of missing out, and so let's create our own little opportunity, tokenization of everything. And some people cynical understanding that as long as they're first to an ICO and sell within 30 minutes, you know, you make money no matter what, or you did. All that stuff, though, is, let's say, in a way of classical economic theory, it's just a way to shake out dumb money and upcycle it to people who Bitcoin maximalists would tell you all that money's coming back to Bitcoin anyway. And as the crypto markets move dependent upon Bitcoin, it tells you everything you need to know. It doesn't injure my pride or understanding of Bitcoin to let the ICOs pop up and the altcoins, you know, proliferate, flash out, burn out. There's a huge fossil record of altcoins already. Let's learn what it is that's valuable about Bitcoin through this experience.
Yeah, it's once I started learning all this and I really started understanding what ICOs were, that definitely turned me off it makes you want to concentrate just on what the main guys, the people, the Bitcoins, the Ethereums and the Litecoins, what they're doing, and really not look at every single thing that pops up.
Let's stipulate, though, that, I mean, there was plenty of money to be made in all these altcoins and Ethereum and Ethereum's new tokens, and still tons of money that was made and money to be made. But again, like from a point of principle and stuff, like it was never my ambition, and I don't think it's a good libertarian's ambition to just try to find something that's hot and get in on a pump and dump early. I mean, not that there's mad respect if you can make money in this game, because it's just like playing, you know, other types of securities on the open market. But you know, that's a separate conversation from, you know, what's so great and ultimately liberating about crypto.
Well, yeah, I mean, the understanding that it's a great tool to subvert the state, to reduce the power of the state, especially monetarily. I mean, if you understand that fiat currency is the reason why they can have these ridiculous wars and bomb 14 different countries, because they can just print all the money they need to do in order to do it. And if there was still some semblance of a gold standard or sound money, that the, you know, they wouldn't be able to do it. So, you know, anything, you know, I'm always one of these people that, I mean, I do encourage people to try to pay for things in crypto as much as they can, because it just keeps the tax, you know, it's just that little extra bit of agorism goes a long way. And especially if they're monitoring, because we know they're monitoring everything. They, you know, they can see that people have that mind. More people are having that mindset now of what can we do to starve the beast. And mm-hmm. I think crypto is a could be a main tool in order to do that down the road.
I've accepted Bitcoin in our business for a long time. I mean, since like in our milling business from the beginning. You know, you can buy our mill and everything that we sell in Bitcoin. And even I think now that I use Coinbase, I've only been doing that since this year. We accept Ethereum as well. And, you know, so you can even use inferior cryptocurrencies. But I agree. I think the bigger thing is, like, can you create a kind of ecosystem of people who are always accepting it, always trading in it? And that's a huge thing, because it's a parallel structure, total free sphere of action outside of state channels. And that's really the essence of what we talk about. So it's important to actually practice these things, rather than just sit on a pile of Bitcoin and just hope you get rich. That's not the same thing.
Yeah, I'm going to be speaking at Liberty Forum in New Hampshire in February 2019, and I very much look forward to the fact that Manchester has, from what I've been told, every business accepts cryptocurrency up and down the main street. And yeah, you go into a state where a lot of businesses accept cryptocurrency and everybody walks around with wallets on their phone. So.
I just got invited to speak out there. So maybe you and I can have that famous cup of coffee via Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from what I understand, pretty much any place you walk into, you can get it. So I wrote two books, and I sell them for cryptocurrency on my website. So yeah, I'm all in, man. It's
You know, the minute Amazon decides to, I know they studied it. The minute Amazon ever goes for Bitcoin, I mean, it's probably over at that point, right?
I think they bought domains last year for Amazon Ethereum and I think Amazon Litecoin. I'm not sure if I didn't hear about Amazon Bitcoin, but I'm sure that one was there too.
I've seen things in the past, like developers, you know, secreting out these screens of the checkout window, and so, you know, you never know what's exactly real, but it smells just like the incognito iPhone tests and stuff. They've been looking at it for a long time.
Yeah, I saw it came across my Facebook feed, a cash register that takes now, it takes like 8 different coins. And they showed, like, someone did Dash with it, and it was literally over in like 30 seconds. The transaction was over in 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's great. You have Lightning and all these things. So I'm certainly optimistic about the crypto space. And you know, I should have said one other thing about why I'm even glad that there have been altcoins. In the case of like R3 and XRP and these things, like it's fun to watch the statist, you know, collaborators waste their time and money working with the state on, you know, state backed cryptos or something, watching it all fail. You know, we got rid of Mike Hearn that way. Mike Hearn rage quit Bitcoin at like 300 and said, like, that's it. It's done. So it's good to have altcoins to attract, you know, like the poised minds away from us.
Yeah, I think there'll always be altcoins. I think the market will always, there's always going to be, someone's always going to want to try and compete. And I think that's really good. Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah.
Super healthy. Like, I don't really have a dog in the fight. I still have all my Bitcoin Cash from the fork, you know? So
you didn't get rid of it. You're not a dum-dum.
maybe they'll win one day for no reason.
Yeah, who knows? But, well, I mean, I don't have anything else. Is there anything you want to plug?
Nah, I should probably say, though, I've been seeing some misunderstandings online about just what the measure is of this settlement and its scope, what it means. I don't want people to think that this just applies to the 3D printing of guns, which is admittedly like a bizarre and kind of niche thing. This settlement applies to the entire intellectual property, digital intellectual property of all firearms, all the firearms we care about and their accessories and other components. So what this means is, maybe I already said this with you, I don't recall, but really what this means is guaranteed safe passage of our culture, of our industry, and of the future of that industry into the internet, into the 21st century. And it really, I don't think it can be overstated when looked at in those terms what this means for the future of the individual access to the right to keep and bear arms.
From the first time I heard you speak on the Tom Woods show, I guess a couple of years ago, I knew that you had a vision that was bigger than most people. And it's just really been a pleasure talking to you. And God, if more people in this world concentrated on accomplishing the things that you did by the time they died, much less by the time they were 30 years old, we could, I think we'd see some real change and some real liberty in this lifetime.
Kind of you to say, man. There's a lot of money out there and a lot of so-called libertarians. All we got to do is direct a percentage of that energy, and you can get quite magnified results.
That's why I'm in this hot closet sweating while I'm talking to you, man. That's why I've done this over 130 times now, because just trying to get the message out there, man. And thank you for you've done it. You've gone so far beyond what most of us are going to be able to go beyond, and we need the trailblazers. And thanks, man. Most people who know me know I'm not an ass kisser. So that's from the heart.
Thanks. Thank you, really. I mean, it was fun to do, and I feel that way about it too. Like that it is a great thing, and I hope we can consolidate the victory. But I don't want people to come away with this being like, wow, that's great. There's this guy and he did all this stuff that's like more than I can do. I never had a background in any of this. The only way that we're going to do anything that we want to do is to pick up the shovel, right? To pick up the tool and to teach ourselves how to do the thing that we think is important. I don't want this to somehow, I don't know, for me to become like this guy who was always going to do this and I have special powers. I'm nobody. I'm not qualified to do anything. I have a particular wit and mischievousness, but like that's all that's required. And I think that should be a takeaway as well.
Thanks, man. This was great. I really appreciate this. And I know a lot of people are going to want to hear this. So thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Hey, and I'm happy we could meet.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to be at Liberty Forum, maybe we can have a little more than coffee. All right, man. Take care. I want to thank you for tuning in to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Cody for coming on today. I want to remind you about my books. They're available on Amazon. They're available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. Check them out. I'll be back in a couple days with another podcast. So take care and bye.